never is like always, absolute. And in absolute darkness, when you can't see your hand in front of your face, is that your hand? You may find that you see other things, things that have always been there, and what is there can see you too. The Cipher, Kathy Koja. Hi, this is Carla. Welcome back to There Might Be Cupcakes. Welcome back to spooky season, and welcome back to the Navidson's house on Ashtree Lane in Virginia. Before I continue, please, I apologize if you hear some slight murmurings in the background. That's my producer, Ellie, the senior dachshund, snoring. You should know, in thinking about preparing this episode, I have been having peculiar dreams. Not exactly nightmares per se, but unsettling dreams about large buildings that grow, that are otherwise too large for their purpose, and that have corners that I can't see into, which has been fascinating. I also realized, while outlining my first two episodes in my new commonplace book, which was lovingly gifted to me by the splendid Archer and Olive Stationery Company, I posted a picture of it on the podcast Instagram, There Might Be Cupcakes, that this deep dive analysis that I'm taking with this novel is the very same journey into obsession that Zappano, then Johnny Truant, took with the Navidson Record VHS tapes and documentary. Looking at my notes, of course, in blue pen, because I have a sense of humor about my obsessive intellectual researches, the word house in blue throughout. And the book, with bookmarks and post-it notes fattening it up, I am amused and also wondering about the surreal dreams that are to come. So, when last we left the Navidson-Green family, Will, who goes by his last name Navidson, Karen, their kids Daisy and Chad, and their Siberian husky Hillary, and their tabby cat Mallory, and their house that is slowly growing bigger on the inside, and apparently still growing. Navidson and Karen's two videotapes, 5.5-minute hallway and exploration number 4, were circulating amongst the public like the cross between a fever dream and an urban legend, a whisper on the wind about a domestic horror show, about a home that wasn't a home, that wasn't safe. The worst scary story you could tell in early 1990s America, a beautiful suburban home with squared walls and shingles and matching siding, is not safe for the 2.5 kids and the dog. The middle-class American dream is not safe. Bright lights and the family around the dinner table every night and the two-car garage and new-growth trees was the actual portal to hell, and you could watch the proof on a VHS tape. Maybe Poltergeist had been a documentary.
They're here.
Before we rejoin the Navidsons, I want to share with you some other surreal novels of demented domiciles. My own phrase that I coined for houses that just aren't right in some way, that fit somewhat alongside House of Leaves. Now, House of Leaves stands alone, to be honest. It and its companion volume, The Whalestow Letters, which is linked in the show notes, and which we will discuss in a later episode. But other novels have explored demented domiciles that get inside the dwellers and readers' heads and emit uncanny auras and worlds of their own inside their walls. They have the same vibes of, well, as I said, fever dreams, of the house being awake while the dweller dreams. Demented domiciles have been a favorite genre of mine for a very long time, for as long as I've been reading horror, which is way back into elementary school. A house that is not just haunted by ghosts or demons, but that haunts the living itself. The first is a book by an extremely talented friend of mine, The Cipher by Kathy Koja. It won the prestigious Bram Stoker Award and Locust Awards, was the finalist for the Philip K. Dick Award, and was named one of iOS9.com's top 10 debut science fiction novels that took the world by storm, unquote. Because it did. This book is wild and woolly and hypnotic. Quote, black, pure black, and the sense of pulsation, especially when you look at it too closely, the sense of something not living, but alive. Sounds like both the Navidson house and Johnny's first response to Zapano's record of it, doesn't it? Compare. Quote, one thing's for sure, even without touching it, both of us slowly began to feel its heaviness, sense something horrifying in its proportions, its silence, its stillness, even if it did seem to have been shoved almost carelessly to the side of the room. I know a moment came when I felt certain its resolute blackness was capable of anything, maybe even of slashing out, tearing up the floor, murdering Zapano, murdering us, maybe even murdering you. Synopsis. Quote from the publisher. When a strange hole materializes in the storage room, would-be poet Nicholas and his feral lover Nakoda allow their curiosity to lead them into the depths of terror. Wouldn't it be wild to go down there? Says Nakoda. Nicholas says, we're not. But no one is in control, and their experiments with it lead to obsession, violence, and a very final transformation for everyone who gets too close to the fun hole. The fun hole is what they and their friends begin calling the hole, the void. Kathy's writing is luminous and dark at the same time. Quote, the same sweet ghost howl, not so much siren song as the song that charms sirens. Ugh. Quote, she sighed, a sad little sound that made more melancholy the backdrop of the sullen afternoon. Dusty shadows lying on flat oblong planes, making of the whole room a complicated rebus of exhaustion and want. So evocative and amazing. Amazing doesn't do it justice. If a hole to nowhere, anywhere, opened up in a room in your building, would you explore it? Would you tell anyone? Would you be afraid of it or drawn to it? Would you try to close it? The next is a novella that is over 100 years old. The Willows is a novella by British author Algernon Blackwood, which is one of the coolest names. It was originally published in his collection The Listener and Other Stories in 1907. It's an extremely important work in horror, being highly influential on other authors, especially H.P. Lovecraft. It was a favorite of his, according to the website The Lineup. It's an unusual demented domicile, but it's surreal enough to share. It fits. Synopsis. Okay, two friends take a boat trip together down the River Danube. Midway through a trip draped with and roofed by willow trees, they stop at a small island to rest. But this island is not quite of our world or time. The next one on my list takes us to the 1970s, then through the next five decades. Slade House by David Mitchell, published in 2016, made me dizzy when I read it, in the best way. Slade House can't always be seen on its British street. You actually have to look at it sideways, and even then, the conditions have to be just right for you to see it. Its narrow iron entrance and even smaller front garden. A stranger standing on its stoop might know your name and greet you and invite you inside. And then you won't want to leave. But if you do, you wouldn't be able to. An extremely strange brother and sister pair give this invitation to one person every 9 years, to one very lonely and unusual person. And then they disappear into Slade House, and then Slade House disappears. Interestingly, the motif of falling shows up in Slade House just as it does in The Cipher and just as it does in the most famous surreal novels of all time, Alice in Wonderland and Alice Through the Looking Glass. Quote, but my question falls down a deep well with no bottom, and I forgot what I've forgotten. This next one is one of my favorites, and it's oddly the only horror novel written by this author. The House Next Door by Ann River Siddons. Siddons wrote novels about relationships, about complicated relationships, about how people relate to one another, so she captured perfectly how this malfunctions. This one is extremely unusual in that the protagonists do not live in the demented domicile, but rather, as the title says, next door. It's a nice brand new house constructed next door to their nice brand new house in the suburbs of Atlanta. The middle class American 1990s dream, just like House of Leaves. New siding, matching shutters, a newly seeded lawn. And this upwardly mobile happy couple, Walter and Colquitt Kennedy, begin to notice that this house is eating its occupants alive, bringing out their worst secrets, making them do things that ruin them, in short, tormenting them into ruining their American dream. So they start warning people, for they are also haunted by this house, haunted by watching people lose everything. And because it's horror, it doesn't go well. The next house, Key House, in Lovecraft, Massachusetts, if you could guess by the name, is also very demented. It was created by the masterful Joe Hill, son of Stephen King. I love Joe Hill's work. This is a graphic novel series, and now a horror series on Netflix, newly in its second season, called Lock and Key. Lock spelled with an E at the end. Here's the official synopsis. Quote, following their father's gruesome murder in a violent home invasion, the Locke children return to his childhood home of Key House in secluded Lovecraft, Massachusetts. Their mother, Nina, is too trapped in her grief and a wine bottle to notice that all in Key House is not what it seems. Too many locked doors, too many unanswered questions. The older kids, Tyler and Kinsey, aren't much better. But not youngest son, Bodie, who quickly finds a new friend living in an empty well and a new toy, a key, that offers hours of spirited entertainment. But again, all at Key House is not what it seems, and not all doors are meant to be opened. Soon, horrors, old and new, real and imagined, will come ravening after the locks and the secrets their family holds. Basically, this family has inherited special keys that don't just open doors, and this house, too, is much bigger on the inside. It's surreal and spooky and unnerving and dangerous, and Gabriel Rodriguez's art is stunning. The first volume, Welcome to Lovecraft, is linked in the show notes. I will list the series in order on the website entry for this episode. The Netflix series does a great tribute to the books and is delightful and delightfully dark. This is perhaps as uncanny a universe as House of Leaves in some respects. And the final demented domicile novel, surreal as perhaps House of Leaves, before we go back into the house at Ashtree Lane, is of course Hill House. It's one of my very favorite novels by one of my very favorite authors, Shirley Jackson. Hill House is alive and it breathes and it is hungry. It is your audible suggestion for this episode, and it is narrated by the sublime Bernadette Dunn, who also narrates Jackson's perfect We Have Always Lived in the Castle. Both are linked in the show notes. Remember, if you use the Audible link in the show notes under the section How to Support Cupcakes and are not yet a member, you'll get a free month to check all of Audible out, and you'll get to keep The Haunting of Hill House as your free gift even if you cancel. If you are a member, both Hill House and We Have Lived in the Castle are linked in the show notes, and you'll help the podcast out a little bit using those links. Thank you. I finished Mike Flanagan's adaptation of The Haunting of Hill House on Netflix as I was typing this script. I was so hesitant to watch it when it first came out in 2008. Whoops, that would be 2018. Carry on. Because I watched the 1999 movie version of the novel in theater, and not even the sublime actress, Lily Taylor, could keep me from getting pissed off. It was garish and wrong and disrespectful to the original perfect work. And that's all I'll say about that. This miniseries, a rather incredibly long horror movie, honors Shirley Jackson's work the way the original 1963 movie does. This Hill House plays with time and is ravenous and jealous of the living. The novel is as much about architecture and surroundings as about ghosts, and so is Mike Flanagan's work, and it is an excellent companion, like I said, to the terrifying 1963 movie that also honors it so. I love the usage of names from the novel. I love the playing with the theme that wanting to come home and have a home and how that can be perverted by a sheltered mind. And Mike Flanagan's production used Shirley's words over and over, and I took great joy when I heard them throughout the show. The production was circular, as is the novel. The book's first and last paragraph mirror each other. I want to read them here because, though I am no English teacher, I think they are some of the most important beginnings and endings to an American novel. I would certainly teach them were I ever to lead a writing or literature class. The novel begins, quote, "No live organism can continue for long to exist sanely under conditions of absolute reality. Even larks and katydids are supposed by some to dream. Hill House, not sane, stood by itself against its hills, holding darkness within. It had stood so for 80 years and might stand for 80 more. Within, walls continued upright, bricks met neatly, floors were firm, and doors were sensibly shut. Silence lay steadily against the wood and stone of Hill House, and whatever walked there walked alone." And then ends, quote, "Hill House, not sane, stood by itself against its hills, holding darkness within. It had stood so for 80 years and might stand for 80 more. Within, walls continued upright, bricks met neatly, floors were firm, and doors were sensibly shut. Silence lay steadily against the wooden stone of Hill House, and whatever walked there walked alone." And from squared sound walls, we return to walls that are not. Do you suppose the Navidson house at Ashtree Lane dreams? Or does it exist in that absolute state of reality, that insanity, as Jackson describes, that accompanies those that cannot and do not have the release of sleep? Does it always watch alert? Does it watch the Navidson Green family? Is it alive, as Hill House is? In this section of the book, we learn that the house in Ashtree Lane was quote, supposedly built in 1720. The family's real estate agent, Alicia Rosenbaum, told Navidson that the house had an average of 0.37 owners per year, quote, most of whom were traumatized in some way, unquote. Even though the date is given as supposedly 1720, the history of the house is described as pre-Adamite, before human history. Navidson and Karen learned from Rosenbaum that the family that resided in the house in 1981 wanted to build an L. They moved out because they wanted something smaller. This means they wanted to build a full L-shaped addition to the house, adding another wing, drew up blueprints for this to occur, which Rosenbaum gave to Navidson, and then abruptly moved out because they wanted a smaller home. This bodes sinister for the events to follow, and the events of the two VHS tapes Navidson and Karen created. The book House of Leaves, which is to say Zapano's documents and Johnny's annotations, go now where we are in sections 3 and 4 to the events that shaped the two VHS tapes, June 1990. The Navidson Greens, which is what I call them. They're usually referred to in the book as the Navidsons, but I'm referring to them as that in the podcast because Will uses his last name, Navidson, and everybody refers to him as such. So the Navidson Greens come home to Ashtree Lane for a 4-day trip traveling to a friend's wedding in Seattle to find that their house has grown, developed a closet in their master bedroom. A door opens into a 5-foot-wide-by-4-foot-long black tunnel in the master bedroom. At the other end of this new room, another identical door, which opens now into their children's room. The door is white with a glass doorknob, the other door is identical, and the inside of the closet is black. Their children are delighted, not scared at all. They find this great fun, this new door from their parents' bedroom to their own. The adults question whether or not someone broke in and did this to their house, never mind the spatial improbability of an extra 5 feet by 4 feet between rooms. But they check the motion sensors and that are set up to the Hi-8 cameras, and the tape jumps from the family's exit from the bedroom to their entrance, and the door just appears on camera when the tape restarts. Interestingly, the section of the novel begins with a quote from the Bible, the Old Testament, Exodus 3:11. "But Moses said to God, 'Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and free the Israelites from Egypt?' And then the next sentence is, 'Why Navidson? Why not someone else?' This hints to us, I believe, that Navidson's explorations of the growth of his house, of the 5.5-minute hallway, of the creation of the Navidson tapes, of it and Poe's song, both to come, are a burden placed upon him, a dangerous burden, and perhaps some sort of liberation of whom? His family? Someone else? Future dwellers of the house? Us, the reader? The context of this verse is the burning bush appearing to Moses, God speaking to him in the visage of a burning bush as Moses is tending his family's flocks as a shepherd. Food for thought as we continue. It also begins with the Dorothea Lange quote about how a photographer must become a photographer. Quote, "It is no accident that the photographer becomes a photographer any more than the lion tamer becomes a lion tamer." Which I think is there to remind us about how Navidson's photography career began in danger, in war photography, in photographing awful events and awful human nature, which is exactly why he and Karen have agreed to stay home and create this documentary about home life. To quote Johnny Truant in the footnotes to this section, "It's so hard to argue with these whirls of melted flesh." And then the photographer Lange's quote is followed with another quote, this time in a subtitle, about not wanting to go on a quest, this time from Dante's Inferno, not the first time Dante is quoted in this book, and I think it won't be the last. "But why should I go there, and who grants it? I am not Aeneas. I am not Paul." Navidson himself echoes this cry and Moses' question in the Exploration Number 4 video with the explicative, "How the fuck did I end up here?" He is not answered by either God or Virgil. Johnny's footnotes continue to help flesh out Navidson's story as he tells his own. His own war stories, true or not, echo Navidson's wartime photography. Quote, "They usually look away. My stories actually help them look away. Maybe they even help me look away. But I guess that's nothing new. We all create stories to protect ourselves." This quote, once again, brings to mind Heather from the Blair Witch Project, hiding behind her camera as a barrier between her and life. Remember from my last episode on found footage horror, the scene from that movie that I used as that episode's title, when Josh snatches her camera and mocks her, filming her for once. What's your motivation, Heather? She wasn't creating the story for once and had no protection from life. This theme of collection as through filming and ephemera as on the frontispiece image of the book both come up again and again, this time in Johnny's footnotes to the section where he's musing about why he's bothering with Zupano's writing. Quote, "What can I say? I'm a sucker for abandoned stuff, misplaced stuff, forgotten stuff, and old stuff, which, despite the light of progress and all that, still vanishes every day like shadows at noon, going unheralded, passing unmourned. You get the drift." Family is a huge theme in these two sections, as we learn more about the fraternal twins, Tom and Will Navidson's upbringing, and Johnny also writes about his father. The theme of father comes up for the first time directly, rather than as an oblique father figure in Zupano. We find out Johnny's father died violently when he was young, and that the Navidson father was alcoholic, erratic, and often absent. Quote, "Both brothers learned to identify with absence. Mrs. Navidson cared more for being an actress than being a mother." In a brilliant foreshadowing quote, Zupano explains, purportedly in her own words, "All she wanted to do was bring down the house." This explains why Navidson wanted to capture permanence on film and why creating a home is so important to him. Quote, "Tom just wants to be. Navidson must become." In this becoming spirit, Navidson must learn all he can about this new dark closet. He starts measuring and recording his measuring, and he discovers the house is bigger on the inside now. Karen is Navidson's doubting Thomas. She refuses to believe that the house has grown, that the closet has birthed a change in the house. He calls his brother Tom, who builds houses, his friend Bill Reston, an engineer from the University of Virginia. And Karen calls in her friend Audrey McAuliffe down from D.C. for support with this craziness. The women build a bookshelf in the bedroom and film it for the documentary, while the men debate faulty equipment and operator error. Quote, "The impossible is one thing when considered as a purely intellectual conceit. After all, it is not so large a problem when one can puzzle over an Escher print than close the book. It is quite another when facing a physical reality the mind and body cannot accept. Karen refuses the knowledge, a reluctant Eve who prefers tangerines to apples. And so, this part of the novel begins with several versions of "Why me?" and ends with Karen screaming on the tape. The uncanny is addressed by way of the German philosopher Martin Heidegger. I hope I'm pronouncing that name correctly. His work is quoted in the text by Zappano and translated and expounded upon by Johnny in a footnote from Heidegger's work Being and Time. Quote, "In anxiety, one feels uncanny, the, quote, nothing and nowhere. But here, uncanniness also means, quote, not being at home." Now, remember from the last episode when I quoted Navidson, he said he was still afraid of the house and warned people away from it, saying there's nothing there. And I wondered if he meant nothing as a positive, as if there was a nothingness there, you know, like the nothing in the never-ending story. That resonated with this idea of Heidegger as the uncanny being a sense of the, quote, nothing and nowhere. Eerie idea, isn't it? Here's Johnny Truant expounding upon this notion of the uncanny. Quote, "Nevertheless, regardless of how extensive his analysis is here, Heidegger still fails to point out that unheimlich, when used as an adverb, means, quote, dreadfully, awfully, heaps of, and an awful lot of. Largeness has always been a condition of the weird and unsafe. It is overwhelming, too much, or too big. Thus, that which is uncanny or unheimlich is neither homey nor protective, nor comforting nor familiar. It is alien, exposed, and unsettling, or in other words, the perfect description of the house on Ashtree Lane. In their absence, the Navidsons' home had become something else, and while not exactly sinister or even threatening, the change still destroyed any sense of security or well-being." Before I end this episode, I want to address one obsessive footnote of Johnny's. There are no coincidences in this novel, nor nothing done by accident. In questioning the how or why of the closet's appearing, Navidson suggests wryly that someone broke in and created it. Johnny footnotes this, "Who?" quotes. Quoting the poet Rainer Maria Rilke, and again, I apologize if I'm pronouncing his last name incorrectly, in his poem Orpheus, Eurydice, Hermes, the word "who" does not need to be cited, but yet he mentions finding it in the poem as if researching a quote. This poem was mentioned for a very specific reason. As I've said, this novel is a labyrinth unto itself. It is a strange, eerie, and yes, uncanny poem I found when I looked it up, and I think it bears reading. Before I do, I want to point out that Orpheus and Eurydice, their story is not the first mention of snakes in these two sections of the novel. Eurydice is killed by a snake bite, but Orpheus is allowed to rescue her from Hades as long as they don't look back. And Nag and Nagina from Rikki Tikki Tavi also come up. Hermes, known as the messenger and the winged trickster, has as his symbol the winged staff with two entwined serpents. Arthur Framingham, a Princeton University archaeology professor, thought Hermes might have existed as a Mesopotamian snake god. Very interesting. The first line and the second verse of this poem are what strike me the most with regards to the house. See what you think and let me know on Reddit, Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. Those links are in the show notes. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. Next up is another Boo Without Goo episode, another full list of horror movies for the squeamish, just in time for Halloween, and then the fourth House of Leaves episode. I hope you're enjoying this exploration of the Navidson record as much as I am. If you read these sections, as I've stated in the first two episodes, you'll find I left out a lot. I'm making sure that you can enjoy reading the novel, that I'm leaving out a lot of spoilers, but that you can enjoy listening to this without reading the novel. It's a tricky balance. But please let me know if you're enjoying it. This is all about us having fun together. Orpheus, Eurydice, Hermes. Rainer Maria Rilke. This was the eerie mine of souls. Like silent silver ore, they veined its darkness. Between roots, the blood that flowed off into humans welled up, looking dense as porphyry in the dark. Otherwise, there was no red. There were cliffs and unreal forests, bridges spanning emptiness, and that huge gray blind pool hanging over its distant floor like a stormy sky over a landscape. And between still, gentle fields, a pale strip of road unwound. They came along this road. In front, the slender man in the blue cloak, mute, impatient, looking straight ahead. Without chewing, his footsteps ate the road in big bites, and both his hands hung heavy and clenched by the pore of his garment and forgot all about the light layer, become like part of his left hand, rose tendrils strung in the limbs of an olive. His mind, like two minds. While his gaze ran ahead like a dog, turned and always came back from the distance to wait at the next bend. His hearing stayed close like a scent. At times it seemed to reach all the way back to the movements of the two others, who ought to be following the whole way up. And sometimes it seemed there was nothing behind him but the echo of his own steps, the small wind made by his cloak. And yet, he told himself, they were coming once. Said it out loud, heard it die away. They were coming. Only they were two who moved with terrible stillness. Had he been allowed to turn around just once, wouldn't that look back mean the disintegration of this whole work still to be accomplished? Of course he would have seen them, two dim figures walking silently behind, the god of journeys and secret tidings, shining eyes inside the traveler's hood, the slender wand held out in front of him, and wings beating in his ankles, and his left hand held out to her. This woman who was loved so much that from one layer more mourning came than from women in mourning, that a whole world was made from mourning, where everything was present once again, forest and valley and road and village, field, river, and animal, and that around this mourning world, just as around the other earth, a sun and a silent star-filled sky wheeled, a morning sky with displaced constellations. This woman who was loved so much. But she walked alone, holding the god's hand, her footsteps hindered by her long grave clothes, faltering, gentle, and without impatience. She was inside herself like a great hope, and never thought of the man who walked ahead or the road that climbed back towards life. She was inside herself, and her being dead filled her like tremendous depth. As a fruit is filled with its sweetness and darkness, she was filled with her big death, still so new that it hadn't been fathomed. She found herself in a resurrected virginity, her sex closed like a young flower at nightfall, and her hands were so weaned from marriage that she suffered from the light god's endlessly still guiding touch as from too great an intimacy. She was no longer the blonde woman who sometimes echoed in the poet's songs, no longer the fragrance, the island of their wide bed, and no longer the man's to possess. She was already loosened like long hair, and surrendered like the rain, and issued like massive provisions. She was already root. And when all at once the god stopped her, and with pain in his voice spoke the words, he had turned around. She couldn't grasp this and quietly said, "Who?" But far off, in front of the bright door, stood someone whose face had grown unrecognizable. He just stood and watched how on this strip of road through the field, the god of secret tidings, with a heartbroken expression, silently turned to follow the form, already starting back along the same road, footsteps hindered by long gray clothes, faltering, gentle, and without impatience.